Thanks for listening to this Arrow FM podcast, shared on accessmedia.nz with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Good morning, good morning. You are with Camille on her show, Everyday People, here at Arrow FM 92.7, your community access station. And what a beautiful day it is out there. We are at 16 degrees and it is mostly cloudy, but I'm pretty sure that's going to clear up and we're going to get a really big high. I'm not even going to try and predict the high today because I never get it right. Weather people always lie, we know this. But I can tell you it is going to be hot in the next few days are going to be absolutely hot as well. I am so excited to have you guys here with me this morning. I have had a wonderful weekend. I hit the Extravaganza Fair in Carterton at Carrington Park in the weekend and got myself some new earrings, so that was pretty cool. And that's about it, really, just lazed around the home. What is happening on my show today? Well, this morning I have Aaron Slight, and I am really excited about talking to him because, come on, he's a Masterton boy. Well, I hope he is. Let's find out very soon. And after that, I'm going to play some music and then just talk until it's time for me to go, really. Aaron Slight, welcome.
Oh, cheers, Camille. Yeah.
It's so good to have you here.
Yeah, no, it's cool to come in. And, I'm a Masterton boy. Born and bred here.
Excellent.
Yeah. Excellent.
So, well, that starts off our interview really well. So you grew up here in Masterton, and school in Masterton, where did you go and what was that like for you?
School started off okay for me, but probably didn't end too well. I started by going to Central School, which is now Masterton Primary School?
Yes, MPS.
Yeah, so MPS, went to MPS, then Masterton Intermediate, and then I ended up at Macora. So I think because we were in those days zoned to that side of town.
Yes.
So it started off okay there, and then I just lost my way a bit and found motorcycles and didn't sort of get to class and stuff like that.
It sounds like it was a good thing, though. Not that we, like, want to promote that sort of thing, but if you find a passion. So you found your passion, obviously, in motorcycles. I really want to know how did that begin? Who inspired you? And where did the aspiration come from?
Yeah, well, that's a bit of a weird one, really. My dad, my mum and dad, they weren't into motorsport at all.
Oh.
Dad never ridden a motorbike. And we had a little scooter to get to work on. But an uncle of mine, about four uncles of mine were into big road bikes.
Ah.
And one of them actually got a little mini bike as a down payment for something. And so we went away for Christmas and I wanted to hire these mini bikes. And Dad said, we wouldn't be around. We couldn't afford to hire these bikes far up north. He said, if you're so keen, why don't you ask your uncle to borrow his? So, after sort of 6 weeks plucking up the courage, I asked him. And next thing, we had a motorbike in our back paddock, which was the Scout then in Columba Road at the time. So I could ride around at the Columba Road Scout then in their paddock and round. And, so it started there. I can remember the vivid memories back then of going out and my dad saying, so the first week you ride the bike around in first gear, the next week you ride the bike around in second gear, third gear, whatever. About 3 days into it, I had to go home and ask someone to pull it out of the fence because I'd been, so it all started there. And then it just, it was really by fluke. And then I went down to, saw a couple of people I sort of knew, and they said, why don't you come down to the river track? So I pushed my bike down the river, and then from there they were going to a motocross that weekend. And so it was very organic, as you were talking about before. It just sort of snowballed, really.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you did a bit of motocross first.
Yeah, motocross first, and probably one of the things that lent me more to motorbikes is I motocrossed, but then I started working at a bike shop after school.
Ah, what one was that?
So it was Gregory Yamaha at the time. So Ross Gregory, now he's at the lot and has been there for many years.
Yes.
So Ross was a great mentor in getting into racing, the road racing.
Yeah.
As his brother was on he had a sidecar, so we used to travel around. This is after motocross, of course. After school job, that's probably where the schooling went a bit weird, is that I like to go and earn money so I could put petrol in the bike and stuff like that. So I spent more time at the bike shop than what I probably should have done with the books.
I think that it's worked out quite well for you, don't you?
Yeah, no, not too bad.
But it's quite brilliant. So doing the motocross and working at the motorcycle shop and getting you interested in motorbikes, how did that lead to not doing motocross and racing bikes?
So the motocross was really good, and then we got to about 15, 16, and then you want a car, of course, so you sell a motorbike, buy a car and do the car thing and cars and beers and things like that. And
yeah.
That's what happens at that age. And then Ross from Ross Rivers,
yeah.
he said, well, you know, why don't you have a go at this road race thing? You know, we travel around doing it anyway. And so we got into that, and wow. He had a bike, which brings us back to probably a really sad story. As a friend of mine, he actually started work at Gregory's before me as well, a couple of years before. His name was Peter Blackwood.
Mm.
And he got into road racing as well. But Peter was killed in a dirt tracking race at Clareville.
Ah.
So we were both starting to do this road racing. Peter fell off a bike and got knocked on the back of the head. Just a weird accident, yeah. So that was sort of a sad start to the whole thing.
Yeah.
I just started road racing. He was probably in his second or third year. And I probably looked up to him I could see that he was doing really well, you know, changing over from motocross to road racing. You could see that it sort of transferred really, really well.
Yeah.
So then I was starting when the accident happened, and then we just went on from there. It just carried on from that.
Mm. So, I mean, I'm just thinking about how fast you go and stuff like that. But so entering the races, of course, they would have been like national races first. Did you just start kicking ass?
Yeah. It was my first year was pretty good, and things started to happen, and there were some really weird things that came to fruition through the bike shop. We went to a race meeting, and the Yamaha importer at the time, they said, can you bring this motorbike that Ross has got for a spare bike for their team?
Mm.
And they ended up using this bike, and they fell off in it and wrecked it. So then Ross said, well, we'll fix it up and you might as well have it to ride.
Oh.
And so in my first year, I had three bikes to ride.
Oh, wow.
So I did a lot of riding loved it, but a lot of riding. So, just things start to happen. And in about my second or third year, I was winning championships. And then I sort of said, what do I do now? Another thing that, I went to Australia, but to get to Australia, I was reading magazines, and I read this magazine. There was this young guy doing quite well, and I said I sent a letter off.
Yeah.
And said, oh,
yeah.
Why don't you come to New Zealand and join me in the 6-hour race? So it's where you share a bike between you. You do an hour on.
Yeah.
So this Australian Rob Doran came over, and we won the 6-hour.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So then he said, oh, well, why don't you come back to Australia and live with us? So then I got on a plane, went to Australia, sold my car that I had and bought a motorbike there and thought I was going to go to Australia and just everything was going to open up.
Yeah.
Didn't really.
Oh, stink.
I went to Australia, I bought a motorbike because in those days we mainly raced production-based bikes. So you buy a bike you can ride on the road and then you put it into number plates on it and race it.
Mm.
So I did that, but one day when I was running this bike in, because I'm brand new, of course I didn't register the motorbike in Australia. I put someone else's number plate on the back, pulled out past a car on double yellows with a head-on cop coming the other way.
Oh, no.
So I got chased by the cop and pulled over, and then apparently he thought that because the plate didn't match the bike,
I'd
stolen the bike, and so it was all turning to shit, really. we had to go through court over there for all these speeding fines and stuff. But it all worked out in the end, and I got the bike, and we did about four races in 6 months, only four. But in those four, one race I did in Surfers Paradise, I finished second to a guy there on my bike that I worked on with the toolkit it came with. And that guy was Mick Doohan, and Mick Doohan went on to be 5 times world champion.
No way!
Yeah, so I was second to him on the day. It was just starting out his career.
Yeah.
So I sort of followed his path a bit. That year I came back to New Zealand, and we bought another bike, and I won 21 out of 22 races on this bike.
Wow!
And then the next year came and it was like, well, what do we do now?
Yeah.
And Dad said, well, you might as well go back to Australia. I mean, there's nothing happening here.
Yeah.
But this time I decided that I wouldn't live there. I'd work at Ross's.
Yeah.
And I'd fly back and forward. So
oh, wow.
It wouldn't cost me so much. You know, I could actually have a wage and was actually worked out cheaper. So I sent my own bike over, the one that I won 21 races
on. Yeah.
And got there, and from that, the first race meeting, people started offering me to ride their bigger bikes.
So, like, sponsorship deals as well?
Yeah, not really, just their bikes.
Like, yeah.
You know, there's this, they call it the Swan Series of three rounds, and a guy offered me his bigger super bike to ride. He said, well, I'll pay for the whole thing and, you know, come over and ride this bike.
Wow.
So it took off from there. And then Mick Doohan at the time, this guy that's a five-time world champion, he was racing up in Japan.
Yes.
And then he changed rides and went off to ride for another Yamaha team. So the people in Japan said, well, why don't you come to Japan and ride his ride? So I went up to Japan in 1988 and it sort of started from there. That's where I was, I suppose, started my professional career from riding up in Japan.
Yeah, so that's just amazing because you really took off in Japan, didn't you? Literally.
Yeah. Probably a bit later on, but in 88, you know, in Japan, it was a foreign country for sure back then. You know, no one spoke English, no English signs, no nothing back then.
Yeah.
It was quite different and I raced a couple of different bikes up there. Probably struggled. But I was really lucky that one of the last races I was noticed by another team in Australia.
Yeah.
And in a World Superbike race up there, I competed and I think I got a sixth place or something like that, seventh place, which then, you know, got them talking about me. So then I got an offer to ride for Kawasaki in Australia. And the Australian Championship was probably wasn't as big as Japan, but they had probably a better calibre of top races. So some of the guys that were racing in Australia were racing World Championship as well. So you could tell where you were, you know, in the world. Like you could come and race in Australia and get third and think you could probably cut it with the best in the world. So, so in 89, I went and lived in Australia and rode for Kawasaki Australia.
Okay, so I want to know, when you started winning, what was that like for you when you actually, you know, these people that you had watched getting these titles, when you started getting titles?
Yeah, well, the funny thing, I never looked up to people. I didn't think, you know, that I wanted to emulate anybody else.
Yes.
I didn't want to be like them. I just was doing my thing.
And, yeah.
And I suppose I didn't have a dream to be that big. It just happened.
Yeah.
And next thing, you know, and with motorcycling or any type of, you know, motorsport, it's a weekend after weekend. So one weekend you're trying to win and you might finish fifth or whatever.
Yeah.
But you very easily erase that and you're thinking about next weekend.
Yeah.
And it's always your last result that everybody's thinking about. So,
yeah,
you know, you're not thinking that last weekend I did beat them and I have to do it again. It's just, you know, I want to win.
Yeah.
So, and started winning when I went in 1992. So I'm skipping ahead a few years.
No, that's good.
But I went straight to Europe, and the first race meeting in Europe, first time I've ever raced in Europe, I won that race. And it was a world championship race. So that was like, I'm here now.
Yeah.
I can do this.
You arrived.
Yeah. First race in Europe. No one ever sort of done that and won the race.
Wow.
But the World Superbike was a two-race format.
Yeah.
So the next race I was leading. So I'm leading the world championship, my first championship, but the next race I came crashing down to earth with a big crash.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, so leading the world championship 1 minute and then laying on my ass the next.
Yeah,
So that's what it's changing all the time.
Yeah.
So
what would you have to do to prepare for these races? Would you have to keep yourself quite physically fit? Because I can imagine it would be so draining.
Mm.
And you're wearing this leather suit, and you've got a helmet on, and you've got to hold on to this bike for dear life, in a sense. Because what speeds are you going?
The fastest we did back then was like 325, so it's around 200 mile an hour.
Oh, my God.
But people think you just sit on the back of a motorbike, and we used to wear heart rate monitors and things like that. And for the race, you would be sitting at 90%. Peak heart rate for the whole race. And a near pass, a near crash or a passing manoeuvre would spike to 100.
Oh, my goodness.
And you actually don't sit on the seat. You're standing on the balls of your feet the whole time. Because,
no way.
Because you're moving from side to side. And,
yeah.
And a bike's trying to go straight and you're trying to make it turn. So you're
oh
actually...
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's a lot of leverage in the bike.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's quite hard. And the races are, like, the World Superbike format was 40-minute races and two a day. And, you know, now they look back at what you should be doing as a sports person and things, and you probably should only have your heart rate at maximum for, you know, once a week when you're training. You know, so for twice on the Sunday you'd have it peaked. You'd also have it peaked on Friday, Saturday and Sunday because you were testing and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, it's, you do have to be quite fit. And I think I got onto that a bit earlier than everybody else.
Mm.
And when I got to the World Superbikes, people were doing it through natural fitness.
Yeah.
And I was doing a lot of training. So, because I didn't think I was as natural a rider as everybody else.
Oh.
I had to work hard at it.
Yeah.
So I thought if I had something more than them, better than them, if I was fitter than them, which you can do by just putting your head down and doggedly determined to get better. And I could look along the grid and think that, you know, by 40 minutes or by 30 minutes, I'll still have the energy to finish the race. And I think that worked for me as well.
Wow, yeah, because I can imagine, like, what if you got a cramp? Like, has anything like that ever happened to you?
What if you need to go to the toilet?
Exactly!
Yeah. You're lined up on the grid. In those days, there wasn't people, you know, there wasn't sports medicine really, you know.
No.
So you need to keep your fluids up and stuff. And you worked with that by yourself. You know, sometimes you drank too much just before. So then you're on the grid with a full bladder going, what do I do with this? So if you're lucky enough to get off this and go and pee on the side of the wall before you started, well, sometimes it just happened that you just had to relax down the straight.
Because
it was affecting you so much. So there was, we worked at it was new territory, and you've got to remember that professional sports, Super Rugby only became professional in 1995.
Mm.
I was professional sports person from 88.
Yeah.
So there was no one to talk to about
all
the stuff. There was no one helping you out with fitness and all that sort of thing. So I was sort of just, you know, playing with things.
Yeah. Do you get to have any input now? Do you get to mentor anyone, or do you have anyone come to you for advice or anything like that?
Probably a few more years ago than now. Last year I helped a girl, Avalon Biddle. There's a new world championship started for women. So,
oh, wicked.
So she went and did one race in Italy last year. So I helped with her. I've known Avalon for a long time. When she first started, I was finishing, so gave her a lot of encouragement back there and followed her around and gave her some advice then. And actually, you know, gave her a little bit of sponsorship to get to Europe last
awesome.
Year.
Awesome.
But not so much anymore.
Yeah.
Because the thing with motorsport and Kiwis is we're not going to get there unless you've got a big backer.
Yeah, that's so true.
So
yeah.
The local racing, the guys know what they're doing. They've been doing it for long enough. It's about the how do you turn it into a business and get it into Europe.
Mm.
And it's just about money. And in my whole career, I had never had a backer from New Zealand. So,
oh, really?
So I don't think anybody else is going to. There's not big enough companies and big enough profile to warrant backing a Kiwi. So it's pretty hard.
No, so when we talked about this just before we went on air, you retired at 34. So that really is young to retire. And I know that you didn't return to New Zealand straight away. You lived in. Where did you live? Monaco.
Yeah.
Monaco?
Monaco.
Monaco.
Yeah.
Why can't I say that word right now?
Well, no, it is Monaco or Monaco.
Yeah. How long did you live there?
Monte Carlo.
Monte Carlo. I like that one better.
Yeah. So, Monte Carlo is they call Monte Carlo is just where the casino square is. That's Monte Carlo. Monaco is only 800 metres wide by 2.2 km long.
So how did you end up there? Tell me.
Well, Monaco was, so we did the world championship and travelled around in a motorhome.
Yeah.
So that was the best way, like you were at the track and it was really, really good, but it didn't give us any base. You know, we were in campgrounds and weeks off.
Yeah.
So I was looking for somewhere to live, and the team was based in England. But England was a, they were 4 hours into England, so every trip you made, you had to drive 4 hours, get on the ferry, then drive. And so Monaco is very central, but we first looked to maybe living in Italy. But it was really, really hard to, you couldn't rent anywhere without somebody else doing your rental agreement for you because you weren't Italian. And Monaco catered for sports people. So Monaco is full of, it's either businessmen or sports people. And, you know, because the tax rates are so good. So everybody's trying to dodge taxes, you know. And so we, yeah, we settled on Monaco in about, 1997, I think, and lived, there, lived there for 7 years. So it was, it was a great.
Beautiful.
But it's not home.
No.
You don't live in Monaco without a, without a job, you know, that you've got to travel. You know, Monaco's is a great place to relax to, like between the events and things like that.
I can imagine,
So
you returned to New Zealand. You're a retired champion of super bikes, which I think is amazing. You've stood on podiums, and have you done the shaking with the champagne bottle and all that? How is that? What does that feel like?
It's pretty amazing. And one of the biggest achievements is that I won the Suzuka 8-hour in Japan. And the 8-hour race is a two-rider team. It's 8 hours long, and it's 36 degrees. It's 90% humidity. And it's a really tough race to win. And I'm the only one that's won it 3 years in a row with different different partners. And, you know, when you get, when there's 350,000 people would go through the gates over a, 3 day weekend. And you get,
insane.
And you get to shake the champagne and spray everybody that's now climbed the fence and come over to the podium. That place is pretty amazing. And because it finishes at 7:30 at night, they have a big, huge firework display. So it's a pretty special podium. So yeah, that's unreal. That first podium I talked about in Europe when I got up on the podium, that was a bit sad, really. Got up there and they played the Australian national anthem.
No way. No way.
I was the only Kiwi, you know, in the field, and I don't think they thought the first time Kiwi was going to win the race, so they just played the Australian national anthem.
Did you just stand there like, what the hell?
So yeah, there's a lot of differences, and you know, in some of the countries, the champagne wasn't there. So you'd shake up some sparkling apple juice or something.
And so after doing all of that, which is an amazing career, that's for sure, you're back here in Masterton.
Well, how we got here, I mean, you know, ending my career, I didn't want to end, for sure. I was 34. I probably thought, I think 32 is around the perfect age. You've got enough experience. You've got enough youthfulness to carry on. And I thought I had a couple of years left.
Yeah.
But I had a brain bleed.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. So what people call a stroke, which, so it was a natural disaster. It wasn't from hitting my head or anything like that. So you had a vein that hadn't formed into capillaries and feeding my brain. So, well, they call it a malformation of a vein. So what happened is it just, over time, blood pressure burst the vein and gave me a 2.5 centimetre pressure point on the brain. So I was racing in 1998, had my best year ever, missed the championship by 4.5 points. 99, I was just feeling off the whole year. And as I was testing for the next year, I woke up one morning, I had no sight.
Oh, wow.
And I'm, by myself in a hotel room, pulling the curtains back, and my sight was just so bad.
Yeah.
Slowly came round, and I had really, really, really bad double vision. And I was just, couldn't work it out. Proceeded to go to the racetrack, thinking, you know, I'll come right.
Yeah, she'll be right, mate.
Got on the bike and did 10 laps, and I was about 6 or 7 seconds off the pace. And at that time, you're never more than 0.8, 0.7 off the pace. And I just said to the guys, I don't know what's going on, but I just going over these bumps, my brain is not keeping up. It seems to be, I seem a bit blurred vision and da-da-da. But I've been seeing a doctor in New Zealand, and she had a medical file, and she said to me, go and see this girl, this doctor. She's at the Royal North Shore in Sydney.
Yeah.
And she sent my paperwork over, a lot of paperwork. And the last thing she wrote on there, handwritten, was, I've done everything. The only thing I haven't done is imagery of his head.
Mm.
So I went to the Royal North Shore, had an MRI, and found had a bleed on the brain.
Man.
So for me, it was thank God they've found something.
Yeah.
I thought I was going fucking crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. Like
I just, you know, everybody kept saying, because I was complaining to lots of people, and everybody was saying, oh, it's all in your head. Well, it was. It was all in your head.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I had pressure on the brain, and it was near my optic nerve, which was giving me the bad vision. But the optic nerve and all that, where your fine motor skills are, and, you know, I was losing all this perception of... of all these fine motor skills I needed.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, the testing at the end of the year was gone not that well. After having a brilliant year, had a new bike this next year, which I've been developing for 3 years. And then, yeah, this happened. So what happened then was I was operated on in the Royal North Shore, but I was really, once again, bad luck, good luck.
Yeah.
Really lucky that a doctor was flying back from California who'd been actually lecturing on the subject, on my subject.
Oh, my goodness.
So he came and we had elective surgery and, he opened up my skull and took the bleed out.
And you've been fine since?
Oh, sort of.
Sort of.
The thing with a brain injury is that you never get to rest your brain.
Yeah.
You know, you break your arm, you put it in a sling.
Yeah.
But your brain is always working. It's always telling you to do something or sleep or whatever.
Yeah.
So I suffered a lot with fatigue for many, many years. You know, still had afternoon naps and stuff like that. And it was... The other thing that was probably pretty amazing is that when you open up your skull, you lose your driver's license for a year or whatever.
Oh, okay.
So they don't want you driving. I was a professional motorcyclist.
Yeah.
And I was just about to start a season that I should have been winning the championship. So they said to me that I couldn't ride a motorbike for 3 months. No, for 12 weeks. So that meant I missed the first three rounds of the championship. So I had a factory contract with Honda, and so they put another rider in my place. But then I said to the doctor, if you make it not, don't make it 12 weeks, make it 3 months. If you make it 3 months, that means I can get to be in England Thursday before the next race.
Yeah.
So my next race, I had a brain operation, and I was riding a bike within 12 weeks, or within 3 months. And so I... went to Donington, and I think I had an eighth place in my first race back.
Yeah.
That year my results were getting better and better. But looking back, I could see that I was sort of riding sort of one bike length off the back of the...
Yeah.
Maybe it was reaction timing or whatever.
Yeah.
And it was at a time that the championship was changing, and they were going more looking at another championship. The factory Honda, the factory teams were looking at another championship. So they were trying to... sort of bring the cost back. So at the end of the year, they didn't offer me a contract or renew my contract. So I was sort of forced retirement.
Yeah.
But looking back, it was probably about the right time.
Yeah.
You know, I look at some of my other teammates who went on, and they just their careers just got worse and worse and worse.
Yeah.
And worse. They didn't sort of go out on a high. So.
Yeah, and you definitely did.
Yeah. So that was a bit of a weird thing. And, you know, to retire at that young age and, you know, what do you do now?
Yeah.
It was pretty tricky.
Yeah, so honestly, what a journey. Now you're back here in Masterton. You've been back for quite a while, haven't you?
Yeah, we left Monaco in 2004.
Oh, okay, so like 20 years.
Yeah, we came back to Wellington first and Well, after I finished motorcycle, I then got into car racing.
Did you?
Yeah.
So I didn't know this. That's brilliant. Yeah.
So I did the, 2000 was the last year for motorcycling. 2001, I dabbled with a little bit of touring cars in England.
Yeah.
And in 2002, I did the full English Championship in the touring cars. And then 2003, I did some Porsche Championship.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So how did that go?
Good. I'd always dabbled with that because my dream was more to, like, when I was, you know, when I was five, sitting on the carpet, I was pushing around little matchbox cars.
Yeah.
It wasn't motorbikes.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, skidding them around the floor. So I'd always had an ambition to be probably a dream to be a car racer rather than motorcycles, but motorcycling was just my avenue.
Yeah. What an amazing avenue.
Yeah. And just so that's why I thought, well, I'll spend a bit of my money on going into the car racing because, once again, sponsorships and all that sort of stuff. So I sort of paid my way through it.
Yeah.
But I won, I lead in the independent championship in the touring cars all year. And the last race I was taken out by somebody and didn't win the championship. But I thought I'd done enough to be noticed and get a car drive. And it didn't happen.
Oh, damn.
Couldn't be bothered keeping on paying. So
yeah.
Yeah, then I did the Porsches the next year. And then in 2004, we decided to come home.
Yeah.
And so came back to Wellington and was in Wellington for about 3 years. And then Megan, my wife, and I became pregnant, or she became pregnant.
Yes.
So we thought we'd move to closer to the home, closer to the family, and so, yeah, return back here.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant that you're back here. So what do you do in Masterton, apart from being a dad?
What does anybody do at Masterton?
Oh, no, that's such a loaded question.
Well, I was really lucky too, but after that is that my father had a business here in town, and it was the Mitre 10.
Oh, cool!
So it was at a time where the GFC came and things were at a downturn, and after that I've got involved, so that's when we set up the Mega, the Mitre 10
yes.
Mega.
Yes, I love that place.
Yeah, so I'm a 50% shareholder in the Mitre 10 Mega.
Oh, awesome!
Yeah, so that's part of it, but yeah. My main focus, I think, you know, after racing is you know, what do you do and what, how do you keep busy? And you know, I was probably pretty lucky that we did have Mila, our girl. I thought, you know, I'm going to be a stay at home dad.
Yeah.
Not because I want to be at home, but just because we could.
Yeah, that's such a good thing. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I've been around for she finished school last week.
Yeah.
So forever. So she's 18.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've always had stuff to do.
Yeah.
So I do, you know, I did have an ambassador role with Honda for a while in New Zealand and all that sort of stuff. And I've just sort of kept busy. But between the busy spots, there are like down spots.
Yeah. Where,
yeah, what do you do next?
Have you read a book yet?
Yeah.
You have?
Yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant. I should know these things. Oh, my God.
No. That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
My wife and I, we wrote that from Monaco
with
a ghostwriter in New Zealand, and we did that the year that I retired.
Yeah.
The year that I retired. So in 2001, before I started car racing.
Yeah.
Which was awesome, actually. It was a great chance to reflect because when you're on that rolling road, it's just all about next week, next week, next week.
Yeah.
And this was a chance to actually reflect on what you'd actually achieved.
Yeah.
So that was a good process in trying to get into retirement.
I mean, like, what a fantastic career to reflect back on as well, and just the whole scene would have just been amazing because I know that he had quite a bit of fandom going down in Japan, didn't you?
Yeah.
Am I right in bringing that up? Like, that's you, like they're crazy. We're crazy over you in New Zealand. We think you're freaking fantastic, but was it a different kind of level?
Oh, and very much so. Like I say, that race in Japan, they have 350,000 people go through the gates.
Yeah.
But the fans are very different all over the world. Like the Japanese fans are, you know, very honourable and, you know, they're always bowing and hello and being very courteous. And then you go to somewhere like Italy where they're just mad.
Yeah.
You know, and I used to go to Austria and every time I went to Austria, there was a baker in Austria who used to turn up with a cake for me.
Ah.
So I had these cakes that were like the same design as my helmet.
Oh, yeah.
All these sort of things he'd make. because we'd be coming to Austria. You know? So this would be just, the cake would be at the track office for me, waiting for me.
That's amazing. That sort of stuff is amazing. Oops. Now, I really want to know, do you still get out on your bike and do you, you know, go too fast? We won't tell anyone. Do you get to do that anymore?
I don't have a sports bike anymore. I like all people, their sports bikes are so uncomfortable. So, true. So I have an adventure bike, which is like a big trail bike.
You can end up
on the gravel.
Yeah, I know them.
So it's a 1,000cc adventure bike. We do a few trips a year with X races, and we do it, you know, might be a 5-day or five night round South Island or whatever. So it is good fun. We got some great roads here.
We do, don't we?
Yeah, it's awesome roads. And that probably leads me into something, you know, that we're talking about speed and that, but I've been a great advocate for road safety as well.
And absolutely.
And, you know, I still go really fast when I want to, and I think that's what motorcycling's about. But I think on the back road, stuff like that, we can never advocate for no accidents, no deaths. I mean, people are people.
You know,
you can't have people going head on roads and not expecting anything to happen.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. There's always consequences. Yeah. Absolutely.
But that's probably the consequences, and that's what motorcycles are about. We don't want to be saved by anybody.
No.
You know, we're making these choices, these decisions.
Yeah.
People are, these days, are just stepping in to stop everything because I think it comes from work safe stuff like that. Because someone has to pay, they think.
Yes.
But just let us get on with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll sort our own shit out. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Fantastic. Aaron, I say this every time, I don't advocate for a future jumping or anything like that, but where do you see yourself in the future? Or do you have, aspirations or anything like that?
No, I don't really. I don't have aspirations I have aspirations, small aspirations to maybe try and leave the place a better place.
That sounds good.
Really, really corny.
But it's really good though.
We've got a German exchange student with us at the moment.
Yeah.
Living with us. And, you know, things like, we hang our washing on the washing line. We don't put it in the dryer.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just into. I might be burning fossil fuels, but I'm worried about what's going on.
Yeah.
And I'm worried about the track that everybody's leading down is the wrong track.
Yeah.
There's been more carbon burnt these last 10 years than there's ever been.
That's insane.
And we're supposed to be getting greener, which is so untrue because the issue with cars and motorbikes burning fuel. It's not the issue. The issue is making the power to power the other stuff.
That is so true.
And you know, we've got big ships and big planes burning more than cars will ever burn. And I just think they're concentrating on the wrong thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Aaron Slight, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed listening to you. What a fantastic career, definitely. And I love the fact that you're a Masterton boy.
Yep.
Born and bred. We really do like that. And just thank you for coming in and sharing your story this morning.
No, cool. I could talk forever.
It's awesome. So could I. And lucky I can listen as well, which is fantastic. Guys, I've been talking to Aaron Slight here on 92.7. Arrow FM, and I've really enjoyed it. But I'm going to kick him out now, and I'm going to put on a song, English Summer Rain by Placebo. That does not seem to be working for some reason. We are not hooked up properly. Let me have another go. No, that's not working either. Do you know what I'm going to do then? Since I don't know what I'm doing here and we have no technical support, I'm going to end the show. We have done a brilliant show here this morning. We've gone for nearly 40 minutes, so why not? I was going to be finishing in 5 minutes anyway. So what we're going to do is we are going to go now. And thank you so much for joining me. What a fantastic show. See you guys next Wednesday.